Welcome to the Travel Like a Boss podcast, where we interview location-independent entrepreneurs that travel the world like a boss by being their own boss. Here's your host, Johnny FD.
Nick, buddy, it's been a long, long time. How have you been?
Yeah, dude, it has been a long time. I've been well. I mean, I'd had my share of challenges since the last time we spoke, but I'm starting to realize it's just the nature of the game, right? It's just the way it goes.
Well, to kind of rewind a bit, so me and Nick have known each other for a long, long time, probably over a decade. Do you remember where we first met?
I do, in Phuket, Thailand. But it's, how long has it been, bro? I think it's been closer to 15 years.
Wow.
It's been a long time. Yeah, it's been a very long time.
And when was the last time we spoke? Was that actually before COVID or was that after?
I don't even remember, to be honest. I mean, the last time I saw you in person was many years ago, way more than 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So it's been a while.
And I know we've done one episode of Travel Like a Boss together, but this is a follow-up, you know, 5 years later, just as a catch-up, see what's going on in your life, see what you've been up to. I'm back in Thailand, actually, after a long time. It's been since COVID, I haven't been back here, and I've kind of missed it, to be honest.
Wow. Has it changed a lot?
Not as much as you would think. So Chiang Mai is almost the same. It's almost back to the nomad days. I'm in Pattaya right now because it's kind of like more of a mix of city and beach. You know, I don't need the pristine, unexplored jungles of the islands anymore. I want to have a mall nearby so I can go watch Dune 2. Great movie, by the way. You know.
Yeah, how fucking great was that film, dude?
Yeah.
Wow, what a film.
So I think I've changed a lot as well. But I'm curious. I think the last time I spoke to you, you had been living in LA. You kind of gave up your whole kind of nomad life, moved there. I believe you got married. And that ended. I think that's where we left off.
Yeah, well, I actually moved to Arizona and got married there. And then that ended. And then I moved to Los Angeles. It's been 3.5 years now in Los Angeles, which is actually where you used to live, right?
Yeah, that's where I aspired my whole life to move to, because I could live the LA dream. And then when I got there, I realized it wasn't for me, so I moved to Thailand. So that's kind of my, you know, 20-year story. Let's pick up exactly after you moved to LA, kind of like Dune 2 style. What happened then?
So I got to LA, and truth is, I was in a very bad way, man. And I was really lost in a story or a few stories in my mind. And, you know, it was just literally the start of the pandemic, but it was in full swing. It was like a year in. And I was staying with a buddy. His gym was, well, actually, it's an interesting story. So I wasn't actually going to move to LA. I was going to go stay with a friend up in Northern California who's got a big property in the forest in Northern California, about 5 hours north of Los Angeles. And the plan was just to stop in Los Angeles for a brief while, for a couple of nights, just to break up the drive from Arizona all the way up to Mendocino, California. And I came to LA, spent a couple of nights here, stayed at my friend's place for a little bit. And then I got in the car to leave to go to Northern California. And I got like just outside San Fran, and this voice in my head just said, no, you got to turn around. You're supposed to be in LA. And I was like, I don't know if you've experienced that in life. In fact, I know you have, because of the kind of guy you are and the way you live your life. But when you get to those points where you just know, it's like, this is a decision point or a bifurcation point in your life. It's never going to be the same based on this decision that you make. And so I turned the car around and came back to LA. I didn't have anywhere to stay. Only knew like a couple of people. Didn't know what I was going to do. And I was actually staying in my buddy's jiu-jitsu gym where he was staying as well, because he lost his apartment during COVID.
Wow.
Because his gym almost closed. So he and I were both staying in the gym, and it was the middle of this COVID thing, and the area where we were staying was, you know, it was really economically depressed. And it was like 2 months before I'd been like what I thought happily married, like had a house in Arizona and like things were going pretty well. And like my business was just starting to take off. And then, you know, it was amazing how quickly things changed. And I was there, and I was just, Yeah, dude, that was one of the toughest parts of my times of my life, I'd say. And looking back, also one of the best. It's weird how that's a thing. You know, there's an expression I was told by my ex-wife, actually, which is life is sweetest when lived closest to the bone. And man, that was close to the bone. That first 6 months in LA, that was tough, dude. I had to rebuild
I feel everything. I don't need that sweet of a life if that's what it requires. I think I'd rather have a slightly saltier life once in a while. But for anyone who's not aware, jiu-jitsu, aka Brazilian jiu-jitsu, is the sport where you are rolling around on mats with other guys sweating on each other. And during COVID, especially in California, it was definitely disallowed. So I'm not surprised that your buddy's gym almost shut down. I'm glad he survived it. And even though he went through a tough patch and had to live in the gym during the time, but I'm assuming it's still reopened now.
Yeah. And look, it was interesting because he and I, we were good friends before that, but I really feel that our friendship, like, we bonded because we were both like, he was really very angry and very upset at like everything that was going down with COVID because, you know, the government or the state wanted to shut him down and, you know, he lost most of his members. And this was something he had like spent over a decade building up, you know, and so this was a really painful and difficult thing for him. And, you know, we just would be in the gym at night, like just talking shit and like, I was depressed. He was depressed. You know, wasn't the best time in the world's history either. But like, I look back and I know that our friendship was solidified because you know how it is. You only really know someone when the chips, you know, who your friends are when the chips are down. You know, and that guy showed me that he was a real friend. And I mean, if I got nothing else out of that really difficult time in my life, what I received was just a real understanding of who my real friends were and who I could count on in life.
Yeah, I think that's so important, especially when you're in a situation where you don't know where to go. I think a lot of people, when we see homeless people on the street, we don't realize that all of them, you know, had a chance to call up a friend and say, "Hey, you know, I'm down and out. Something happened. Can I come stay with you for a while?" And maybe, you know, half of them or even more, you know, I would almost imagine all of them, you know, had someone to stay with for at least for a few days, maybe a month. But then also depends on how they treated that situation, you know, because I imagine, you know, when you were at the gym, you were being respectful, you were being a good, you know, friend and, you know, host, cleaning up after yourself. And if instead you had gone the other way and just become an alcoholic or just, you know, respect the rules in the house, you could have been back on the street or, you know, had to bounce to another friend, and eventually that burns out. You know, people only have so many friends or connections, you know, whether it's family or church, that they can go to.
Yeah, dude, and I've really found a new compassion for everyone, but specifically for homeless people, because I realized, you know, when I was going through that dark night of the soul, that period in my life, the thing that I understood was that we are all so fragile. Because I went from being someone who I knew what I wanted in life. I knew what was happening. I had my whole future planned out. I was, you know, I wasn't a chump. I was working out every day. I had my own business. I was in great shape. You know, I was someone who was very disciplined, very motivated. And when this happened, it was very interesting to see how quickly all the things that I based my reality upon just broke down or disintegrated. And, you know, I know that it was the people around me that, I don't want to say they were the reason that I didn't end up on the street or didn't end up becoming an alcoholic person or anything. Cause I think, you know, my self-discipline and my will would have probably pulled me through in the end, but it would have been much, much, much worse if I hadn't had those people around me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like there's an expression I'm very fond of when you see someone who's struggling in life, it's but by the grace of God go I. I mean, one little neuron in your brain, right? Or one wrong decision or one piece of bad luck can fucking take you out of the game. And judging people who are in those situations, I just don't think it's a healthy or spiritual approach to it.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And on the other hand, because I've known a lot of people who have been in this situation. Not as much myself, but I mean, at one point in my life, I was down to the last, you know, $300 in my bank account, and I.
I remember I was there, man. Remember you're in Thailand. I was right there.
Yeah, and I could have very easily could have went the other way and just said, you know what, I'm going to spend this last $300 on enjoying myself. You know, going out for the drink or doing something where it wouldn't be productive. And instead, I was like, you know what, I have $300 left. Let me try to build a business. Let me try to do something where I can make something of myself. And maybe I would have failed. And maybe I would have ended up, you know, in the bad spot anyways, and had to crawl home to my parents or crawl home to a friend. And that would have worked, you know, because I had good relationships, you know, fortunately, and not everyone does. But at the same time, even with family, even with good friends, those bridges are easy to burn after a few months of someone just staying there leeching, you know, not cleaning up after themselves, bringing negative energy into the house, or, you know, worse, bringing drugs or alcohol in. So honestly, even though I understand that for some people it's really not their fault at all, and they just had, you know, the bad roll of the dice, I really firmly believe that for the majority of people, they have at least one or two lifelines, and it could literally just be like a church. They don't even need to know the people personally. And you have one or two lifelines, and if you fuck those up, then you're on the street. And or if you go there and you realize, hey, I don't want to follow these rules. I don't want to be home by 10 p.m. I don't want to have to be sober. Then you're on the street. And sometimes that ends up being, you know, easier than the opposite of trying to get yourself back up.
Mm. That's a good point. I mean, I don't know if I entirely agree with his point of view, but my friend, funny enough, the guy I was staying with when I first arrived in LA, it was his gym. He said this thing about homeless people. He said there are, by the time a guy gets to that point, there are so many bad decisions. It's like a chain of many, many, many bad decisions. And I don't necessarily, I mean, I think that's very harsh. It's probably accurate, but the thing to understand, it's a paradox, right? Yeah, it's loads of bad decisions, but all it is one big bad decision or one big bad break can start that chain reaction, right? And tip you over the edge. And unless you have like very strong mental fortitude and people around you and unless your luck turns and a combination of all of those, yeah, it can get real bad, right? So
yeah,
don't ever look down on anyone who's down and out.
I see that. And I remember actually maybe the last time we spoke, and this was, you know, 5+ years ago, you had already been doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, you know, for decades, you know, and you had gotten to the top of the sport and the craft. And I think you had kind of fallen out of love for it, for at least temporarily. But it sounds like what you've learned from your time, you know, in the discipline has kind of helped you through this as well, just at least mentally.
Yeah. Look, man, if you do anything for long enough, there's anyone who claims to love everything about a person or a vocation or whatever, like whatever item in the world, like you can't love everything about something as broad as that, right? It's just not possible. And when you're so immersed in something for a long time, there's a tendency we can get burned out, right? You know, there's an expression, the candle that burns twice as bright burns half as long. And man, in jiu-jitsu, my candle was burning bright, man. I poured everything into it. And, you know, there was a point where I had started, I'd done so much in the jiu-jitsu industry, and there was so much good stuff that came out of it, so many successes, but also many failures. And it all had taken a toll on me. I had really a painful business failure as well with someone that I'd worked closely with. The relationship just didn't work out. And I basically had to walk away from a business that I'd spent over 7 years working on. And, you know, that wasn't jiu-jitsu's fault, but it was a jiu-jitsu related business, you know, and I had a bunch of injuries. My body was beat up, and like the game had changed a little bit. Like, and yeah, there was a period where I didn't really enjoy it, and I was kind of over it. But what I had to do was redefine my relationship to it and my expectations of it, because I was still approaching it like I was that 23-year-old kid to start a training, and I realized, I'm not a competitor anymore. I'm not like indestructible like I was when I was that age. I'm different now. My body's different. I've got a different set of skills. Like I can't keep trying the same strategies and expect them to still work. I've got to change, like, not only my relationship to this thing, but also my perception of it.
Yeah, it definitely absolutely makes sense. And it's very similar to my story with scuba diving. I worked as a professional dive master and instructor when I came to Thailand for, 5, 6, 7 years. And I was doing it every day. And I absolutely loved it. If anyone spoke to me those first 3 years and you asked me what I did that day, I would have said the same thing. I would have said, I woke up early. I went diving. I saw this. I saw this. I met these people. I had a sunset beer. It was the best day of my life. And I genuinely loved it. But I did over 1,000 dives in those first couple of years. And I actually calculated my bottom time of how long I was actually in the water during those years. And it was the equivalent of a month of my life. I was underwater.
Wow. That's wild.
Yeah. And just like anything else that you burn, the candle, with both wicks, I just started falling out of love with it. I started, getting annoyed with little things that used to not, I used to not even notice or used to not bother me. I started having contempt for, let's say the new divers or like the other styles, or, even people who would buy, really expensive gear. And I'm like, oh, why are they doing this? And, let's go back to the basics. And it was just all these things that I just got annoyed with it. And I realized, if I ever want to enjoy diving again, I need to stop right now. I need to take a long break. Sure. I definitely need to stop having it be my profession. I can't have my income tied to it. And that's why I quit. And it doesn't mean that I regretted those 7 years of my diving life. And it also doesn't mean that I don't want to dive anymore, but I definitely couldn't do it every single day of my life as my job, at least at that point, So that was the best decision.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
I totally understand it. Yeah, it's, it's, you got to be careful when you make something that brings you joy your work, because there is the possibility that you're not going to enjoy it anymore. It's just a fact, right? It doesn't always happen. And as I said, you can change your relationship and your expectations to these things. But like now jiu-jitsu, it's like what I care about is the people. I enjoy being around the people and all the cool people I interact with and the friendships I make. The actual act of jiu-jitsu and fighting and wrestling with people, I don't mind it. I don't hate it, for sure. And it can be fun, but it's not something I love doing anymore, right? I've just done it for so long now. And I used to beat myself up about that. I used to feel guilty. And then I found out that there's a lot of guys who feel the same way I do, especially after this long in the game. So now I treat it, it's less of like this hobby type thing, and it's my profession, it's my work. And subsequently, I'm better at it. It's the weirdest thing. I'm like, I would have thought that, oh yeah, I would have been better at it if I was just being passionate and like fully involved and like in love with it like I was when I first started training. But it's not actually the case now. I come at it like a professional, and strangely, it's improved it for me. And it's improved what I offer to people as well.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. I mean, I think that's with everything in the world. I mean, let's say someone loved cars when they were young, and they used to be a boy racer and fix up their car and drive every weekend, to the racetrack. And eventually, and he worked as a mechanic on the side. Now he's 40 years old. He doesn't want, to put aftermarket parts on and make his car look like a little boy racer. And he doesn't even enjoy, go to the track, but he's a master mechanic. And, he can look at a car and be like, okay, this is what's wrong with it. I think that's perfectly okay. I think it's just maturing.
100%, dude. Yeah, good way of putting it. It's maturing. Yeah, I mean, I used to love watching cartoons when I was a kid. I remember like Saturday morning cartoons are just the best. And then one day I woke up and I was like, hey, I don't like cartoons anymore. And I couldn't figure it out. And I realized, okay, yeah, this is just it. I've like matured. I've gotten older. My tastes have changed.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, there's nothing wrong. I mean, this is why a lot of mechanics drive Toyota Corollas. Not because they're fun to drive, not because it's the most appealing car they've ever driven. It's because they know it's built well, and they know, it's all, probably also one of those things where, because they're fixing other people's problems every day at work, the last thing they want is their personal vehicle, to be a side project on the weekends.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah. So now that you've matured a bit from this, what was the next chapter?
The next chapter, man, well, now I'm growing my jiu-jitsu association, so that involves a lot more of a leadership role than an actual, physical teaching and fighting role. Although I do still teach private lessons and a few group classes each week, and I'm also doing my men's coaching. I'd actually taken a year off from that because, again, I kind of burnt myself out on that. I hadn't been doing that anywhere near as long as jiu-jitsu, but when I started, I threw myself in and I did 4 years of really intense work on that, and then I just hit a point of burnout again. And same thing, I had to change my relationship to it and reevaluate what I was doing it for and how I was approaching it. And so now I'm doing that again, and I have a newfound respect for that profession and what it means and what it requires. And I just have realized that I used to be a bit hesitant and wondered, okay, what qualifies me to help men like overcome their limitations and their challenges and evolve and grow? And when I f started 4 years ago, I was still at the point where I was like, am I really qualified to do this? That's the truth, but after what I went through over the last 4 years, it was almost like my university degree for that profession. I went through some incredibly painful and traumatic and difficult experiences, and in hindsight, I realized that, I mean, they have made me qualified for this. I was broken down, and I had to figure out how to build myself back up. And yeah, it's become something that I really enjoy and something that's really fun for me. So the next chapter is to focus on my jiu-jitsu association and on my private coaching.
Yeah, it definitely makes sense because, like, for example, if I had to learn, let's say, winter survival wilderness from someone, and I had two choices. I had a guy who, had the university qualifications, maybe he got a master's in it, maybe he studied everything, maybe he even went to Ivy League school for it, but he had never actually, spent more than a weekend camping. And actually using the skills in real life situation versus a guy who his plane crashed in the middle of, Siberia. Had to figure his way out for over 3 months and had to figure out all these skills himself, and he made it back to be able to teach it. I'd rather learn from that guy.
100%, dude. Real world experience any day of the week. I mean, unless you're an engineer or someone who has a or in a field that requires very theoretical book-based knowledge, I'd take real world experience any day of the week.
So, what are you focusing on now that it's 2024?
Well, at the moment, I'm working on the association, as I said. So I'm visiting my affiliated gyms around the world. I'm also teaching private lessons here in Los Angeles. That's something I've put a lot more focus on because I really enjoy one-to-one lessons and teaching beginners. And just that's the fun part for me is as I said, people, right? My clients are just such cool people. I was just teaching two brothers today, and they're just such wonderful human beings. And I'm just so grateful for the time I'm able to spend with them, not just to have them as clients, but just to see them and shake their hands and, spend time getting to know them and finding out how they're doing. It's just, that's my thing in life. I'm sure you're the same. I'm at the age now where I've got it. I know enough people and I've got enough friends and I'm established enough that, I'm not desperate for friends or work or anything like that. So I'm only going to engage with people on a social and professional level that I really appreciate and whose company I enjoy. So that's the cool thing is like I basically get to choose my clients, and I just really enjoy, as I said, time with them. And
Wow.
also thinking about getting back into the podcasting game, my podcast was going for about 4 years, and I'd taken a year break because, man, honestly, Johnny, the last year has been it's been very intense on many levels. So now I'm thinking of starting it up again. I might do an episode next week, but focusing on my health as well. I had a lower back issue for a long time and have finally figured out what's wrong with it, and I'm starting to rehabilitate that. It's just a year of consolidation and also growth, you know, just pushing the boundaries, really understanding where my ego's kept me playing the game small and kept me limited, and where I've been stuck in a story, and just committing to going to the next level.
I love that. That was actually surprising that you said you enjoyed teaching beginners, because with someone on your level, you can easily be teaching, you know, someone going to the UFC or something, you know, that wanted to up their jiu-jitsu game. What is it about teaching beginners that you enjoy?
I think, you know, look, I don't enjoy teaching all beginners. Some of them are really difficult, right? But the majority of them, what I appreciate is I don't have to correct their bad habits, and I don't have to really like try to convince them that what I'm showing them is good, because it's, you know, that expression, like it's the empty cup, right? So, you know, it's really cool to know that you're playing such a formative role in this person's journey into this particular discipline. Because I don't know if you've experienced this, but whenever you do something new, the stuff you learn right at the beginning, you learn better than anything else. That's been my experience. That stuff goes in deeper than anything else. And so if you're the beginner's or the person's first contact with jiu-jitsu or anything else, and you teach them something, they're going to remember that forever. And then there's an expression, I must have said there's an expression 20 times in this show already, but a quote I'm fond of is, through teaching, you can become immortal. And that really is the case. I remember my first jiu-jitsu instructor very clearly, and everything he taught me, it will always be ingrained in my memory, you know? So that's a really cool aspect of it. And you can also see the progress of beginners is much faster, and they make much bigger jumps as you get better and better at something. And as you gain a level of mastery, your progress becomes less and less perceptible and more granular. So like I look at my purple and brown belts at the academy, and they do improve, but nowhere near as fast as the white and blue belts improve. So that's the cool thing about beginners, is you actually like see a real tangible or very visceral improvement, which is awesome.
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense, especially with Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. If anyone's never done it before, it's one of the very few, I don't want to say sports, but things out there that if you spent 1 month learning it, you will be 9,000 times better than everyone in the world who's never done it before. It's yeah. One of those things where, like, you know, if you ever need to defend yourself against someone choking you, or to disable someone who's attacking someone else, even if you just had the most basic knowledge, you know, of how to, you know, protect yourself against a choke, or to diminish someone on someone else, that will help you so much, you know, in just that first month, than you know, someone who's never ever done it before, never learned just to tuck your chin, or to, you know, which direction to move your body, you know.
That's such a good point. Yeah, I mean, you're right. Like someone having trained for, as you said, just a little bit, it just makes all the difference in the world, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. There was a quote I was trying to remember, but it flies to my head now. So I don't know if you ever heard of it. It was something like, was the difference between a brown belt and a black belt? And
okay.
The difference wasn't something, you know, about like skill or anything. It was something, you know, just about like time or mentality or something. I can't remember what it is now, but yeah, it's, you know, somebody can stay a brown belt for, you know, years and years and years, you know, and the improvement is from those levels, you know, from blue to purple to brown to black. It takes a lot longer, you know, than for someone to go from zero to learn, you know, from having zero submissions to having one good one, you know, or having 10, you know, 10 basic ones. You're just like,
you're right.
Refining your craft, you know, it's like you're chipping away at the wooden carving, you know, like it doesn't take that long to have the form of a horse if you're making it from a block of wood, but it takes a long time to create those little details that make it, you know,
100%. I know exactly what you're saying. And as the thing about it is just being committed to the process, right? That's something you were the guy who really got me thinking about shortcuts and how like you used to always look for shortcuts. And then one day you're like, okay, this is not the way forwards, right? And you notice the big jump in your own life from that point. And that really got me thinking. Yeah. And I integrated that into my life. And someone summed it up best, which is like, it's just about, in fact, he's my best student, this guy, my best student. He's learned faster than anyone else. He's more committed than anyone else. And actually, I just saw him today and he was saying how it's all about being committed to the process and not really worrying about the results, but just really finding enjoyment in that process. And paradoxically, the more you do that, the more you focus on the process instead of the results, the better the results are, which I thought was really interesting, which I find fascinating as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And ironically, even though we've known each other for so long and we're good friends, I am probably the worst student in jiu-jitsu. Talking about burning a candle on both ends, I'm literally on my first candle still, because I'll burn it for half an hour and then I'll put it away in the shelf for, you know, 6 months and not burn it again until I'm in the next country.
Well, at least you still like keep your toe dipped in the water, right?
Yeah, I mean, ironically, when I was in Ukraine recently, up until a few months ago, I was going every Saturday just for open mat, because that's what I really enjoy. Open mat, I enjoy going there, not having any rules, not having from a lazy point of view, you know, not having that grueling warm up. A lot of people don't realize, but just the warm up of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is often harder than an entire, you know, a fitness class, especially if you're talking about like a group fitness class or a cardio kickboxing class or any of those. And, you know, learning the moves, enjoying the moves, in my mind, and I know this is wrong, I'm still trying to take the shortcut around. I'm like, you know what? I just want to you know, roll enough. And then on Monday through Friday, I just need to get in shape. I need to work on my cardio. I need to lose some weight. And then I will take classes and take it seriously. But I know that's what's been holding me back. And I've literally just been doing the enjoyable part, which is the open mat on Saturdays.
It sounds like you should come for some private lessons when you're in LA, brother.
Yeah.
When are you coming back here?
You know, I'm not for a long time. Geographically, LA and the US in general is just not somewhere I want to go. I'm 100% happy spending my time, you know, flying between Europe and Asia. You know, if I can just go from Thailand back to kind of Eastern Europe, 3 months here or 6 months there, I'll be very, very happy. And
that's cool, man.
The only kind of thing that was bringing me back to the US was to visit my parents. But this year I told them, I said, hey, I really don't want to fly there and just to see them and then not have a big other reason to go. Why don't you guys come here? I'll pay for your plane tickets. You know, it would cost me almost as much for me to fly there and, you know, and live in the US for a few weeks anyways. This way you can go on vacation, you can go, you know, wherever you want. I said anywhere in Europe, anywhere in Asia. And they chose Taiwan because they haven't been in a while, and because China might blow it up any minute now, knock on wood. So I'm meeting them there actually next week.
Oh, that's so cool, man. Yeah, what's that saying? If the mountain can't come to Muhammad, Muhammad must come to the mountain, or something like that. There's some old saying like that. That's basically what you've done, bro.
Yeah.
Brought the mountain to you.
I appreciate the offer, because if I was anywhere near you, that would be, that's always been something that was kind of on the back of my mind. I never said this to you out loud, but in my mind, I was like, okay, if we're ever like living in the same place for 3 months or 6 months, you know, I feel like I'd be motivated to actually train full time. And I think with my 10 plus years of white belt experience, I'd probably be able to finally get my blue belt, you know, quicker than most people in terms of
100%.
It'd be amazing to be under that lineage, because you're under Hodja Gracie. But it's one of those things where, you know, we're just never in the same city, and I know it's my fault, and I know it's an excuse where in my mind I'm like, I also don't want to get promoted just out of like a, you know, a feeling of like pity or something. Like, I'll give you one example. I was in somewhere in Thailand, I won't say specifically where, but it was a very small gym. The owner, he was a Western guy, and he was a older brown belt. You know, I think he was at least in his 50s, maybe like 55 plus, and his body was a bit broken. You know, he's like, jiu-jitsu is a very hard sport on people's body, you know? And I was a pretty good student. I actually, I was actually going, 3 times a week for a couple of months, maybe 2 months. And sometimes we would roll. And his technique was a million times better than mine. And if he was ever on top, there's nothing I can do. He would always tap me, very respectfully, but he would always tap me. There's nothing I can do. But if I ever just crawled my way on top of him and put my, 240 pounds of wrestling experience on top of him and just kind of like grinded my way to his neck, and like there's just nothing a person with back problems at 55 can do to stop a choke. And I think because I was able to, once in a while be able to tap him when he became a black belt, I think he wanted to promote me to a blue belt, because he's like, look, you've been a white belt for 10 years. But in my mind, I was kind of just avoiding it. I'm like, I don't feel like this is the person who I want to get it from, and I don't think I really deserve it. So that's kind of been my journey so far.
Yeah, dude, well, you'll get there one day, brother. Just stick with it.
That's one of the few goals of my life left. And who knows how I'll change my mind if that ever happens. But the other reason why I didn't want to ever get promoted was I didn't want to get a blue belt and then not train and show up once a year to a open mat out of shape. Because I think that's just, it's embarrassing for the sport. I think it's embarrassing for whoever gave me the belt. It's embarrassing for myself, because people would expect a certain level of ability. People don't give out blue belts in jiu-jitsu like they do in other martial arts, where you get it for just showing up for a month.
For sure, brother. Yeah, that's really, really good point. I respect you for that. That's very cool.
Yeah, thank you, buddy. So now that you've kind of paved your new path forward, the people listening to this, I think a lot of them maybe have actually heard your podcast in the past. They're definitely listening now. If any of them are in the LA area, are there any kind of services that you provide now that they can get in touch with you for?
Yeah, man. If they want to go to Coach Nick G, and that's Nick with just a C, no K, so CoachNICG.com, you can see everything I offer there, and you can get in touch with me.
Okay, that's awesome. And the actual association, is that more for gyms, or what is that actually that you kind of
Yeah, that's
mentioned?
for black belts who want to continue their jiu-jitsu training and education, and they want to have someone guide them through not only the business elements or business components of running a gym, but also, they want to keep developing themselves, and they want to keep getting graded, and they want to have a worldwide team of gyms that they can go train at and share stuff with and just be a part of a team. That's what Subconscious Association is about.
Okay, I love it. So, Nick, what's in the future for you? Any travel plans? Any life plans? Would you ever get married again? It's I'm curious.
My man. So travel plans. I'm gonna go to Asia in May. We're doing a subconscious jiu-jitsu Japan tour, and then I'm going to the Philippines to teach at one of my black belts academies there, and then Singapore to teach at an academy there. So I'm looking forward to that. I haven't been to Asia since before COVID, and Japan's one of my favorite places, so I'm very excited to go back there. Getting married again, I think that's very unlikely, man. I just don't think that's a good bet for someone living in the United States. Just especially a man, I just don't think that's the wisest of moves. But I mean, I don't want to say never, because I've said never enough times in my life and been proven wrong, or had to eat humble pie because I was totally inaccurate. So I try not to say never, but yeah, it's unlikely,
Yeah, I definitely see that. And things have changed for me too. I didn't think I wanted to get married before. Just financially, it never made sense to potentially risk half of everything you've ever saved up, and worked hard for in a court decision. But at the same time, ever since, not really COVID, I think ever since the living through Re Russia's invasion, it made me realize how important family is, and it finally made me realize that I want to have kids. And I don't want to have kids, out of wedlock. I think it's just hard for them. So I think that's the only reason I would get married. I would actually probably have a child first and then get married, even though there's all the stigma about, you know, having the pregnant wife or marrying, you know, people say, oh, they only got married because they had a kid. I actually think that's the smart way to do it.
Yeah. Well, geez, dude, if that's what you want, then that's what you'll get, man. Knowing the kind of guy you are, you make stuff happen.
Well, I think this is the one that I can't make happen, but maybe I'll join you in the Philippines and find a nice girl then.
put the intention out there, brother, and be very specific about it. Type of woman you want, what you're prepared to offer in return. And I have no doubts that it'll come to you.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Man, I wish that we were meeting in your summer trip, but you're going to be from May until when?
It's just for 18 days in May. So, middle of May, basically. Yeah.
That's a shame. Yeah, it would have been nice to catch up again. But
one day we'll meet again for sure.
Yeah, let's put that intention in the world that we'll be in the same continent at least sometime.
100%. Yeah, I'll be in Europe next year at some point. So we'll catch up for sure, brother.
Oh, I love it. And if this war ends, I'd love to see you in Ukraine, because jiu-jitsu there is actually a whole different thing. It's wild there. It's I've been to a lot of gyms kind of around the world. Ukraine has been the most interesting. And I'll give you a quick story. Is every gym I've ever showed up to has been completely hidden from the street. Like, you can't walk by and know it's a gym. Someone has to tell you where it is and basically walk you in, because every gym is either in a basement or inside, like, some, you know, the third floor of a school in an unmarked room, and you show up. And now people's English is much better, but when I first started going, no one spoke English. You know, they look like these tough, you know, Ukrainian guys, you know, but they've always been so respectful, you know, and so welcoming to new, you know, to the new students or new visitors, especially, you know, people, you know, who come from other countries. And I know it's, you know, what I like about Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is in general, you get this anyways around the world, you know, unlike other sports. But in Ukraine, it was almost at another level where, you know, because they probably got so few international visitors, they were always really, really respectful. There was never an ego, you know, even though you were walking into their territory. They always want, you know, they were always curious to learn and see what other people, you know, had to offer. And it's now with the war happening, there's always one or two guys, you know, unfortunately, that, you know, are in prosthetics. So there might be guys with, you know, no.
Oh, wow. Seriously.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, there was one guy, he was a war hero. You know, I didn't know who he was. I mean, we just rolled one day, you know, no legs at all. And he was amazing. Jeez. He was fast. He was spinning on top of me. He was grabbing my back. And then after, like, I was speaking to him, and he didn't speak any English. His name is Ruslan. He's all over the social media and the news. You know, as being one of those guys where he went to defend Ukraine. He unfortunately lost his legs from it. And instead of hiding in misery and sorrow, he's, you know, a spokesperson saying, look, you guys can get back to normal life. You know, there's all these great programs now where Ukraine actually has really high-tech prosthetics. I actually visited one of the centers called the Superhuman Center, where it looks like something from the Matrix or in the future, you know? Mm-hmm. And he's, you know, like, he's living a good life. You know, he actually, he came over to my house for, I don't know if it was my birthday or it was a party I was having. Beautiful girlfriend that, you know, is like, or maybe even wife now. Like, you know, it's so nice to see, you know, these women, like, sticking with them, you know, through these, you know, hard times. And yeah, it's really, really an experience that unlike anywhere else in the world.
That's so cool. Yeah, funny enough, I actually was teaching a seminar in Oregon this weekend, and there was a guy who was missing the lower half of one of his arms, and he was a Iraq war veteran, I think the second Iraq war. And he had basically was in a personnel carrier, and a grenade landed in it. And he reached down to grab this grenade and like lost his arm. And I just said to him, man, you're like, I couldn't believe it. I was like, you're a hero. You're just such a hero. And he just couldn't really, he was like, nah, man, you would have done the same. And I was like, man, I don't know if I would have done the same. Like, as far as I'm concerned, that is a very heroic action. So that's one of my only experiences, trainings or being on the mat with someone like that. But it sounds like you've had a few, and that's really cool. What a blessing.
Yeah, and in certain ways, it's they kind of unlock a different aspect of the sport where they can do things that, we can't do. And obviously they can't, play a guard game, right? But they're really good at, kind of spin moves. They're light, so if they ever wanted to compete, they're literally, I don't say half the weight, but they're a third of, they're 2/3 of the weight of somebody with legs and big thighs and everything. And it just shows, I mean, it just shows that it's one of those sports where anybody can be good at. It doesn't matter what's holding you back. There's nothing, there's no reason not to do it.
No, that's awesome.
Yeah. Well, buddy,
Yeah, man.
we'll leave it at that. It's been really fun to catch up. I hope some people will reach out to you and check out some of the services you're providing now, especially if they're in the LA area. I really hope that some people maybe start jiu-jitsu because of this conversation. And it sounds like it's pretty selective, but if you're a cool guy, and he has time in his schedule and you live in LA, he'd be an amazing person to learn under. So definitely consider that. Nick, it's been fun to
Thanks.
hang out.
Thanks so much, brother. I appreciate that. Thank you, brother.
Till next time, thanks for listening, and yeah, stay bossy, I guess. I don't know if
Well,
the well, I it's been so long, I forgot what my outro phrase was, but yeah, it's definitely been fun. Thanks, guys.
thank you for listening to the Travel Like a Boss podcast. If you want to hear more, including the bonus How to Choose the Perfect Niche episode, join our mailing list at travellikeabosspodcast.com. See you next week, and remember, if you want to travel like a boss, you need to be your own boss. So start your online business today and start living the lifestyle you've always dreamed of.